and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bipartisan infrastructure package that Senators Sinema and Portman were expected to present today, which the Biden administration might well take up, although they have already objected to provisions in the bill to raise the federal gas tax, which disproportionately hurts lower-income Americans. Since the Republicans want physical infrastructure without raising taxes, and Democrats want to both invest in human infrastructure and address climate change with clean energy solutions by raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy, the likelihood of a deal for the future as opposed to an unsatisfactory compromise is looking dim. Edward McCaffrey, the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California, and author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, joins us to discuss how much Biden might retreat from his original plan to hike the corporate tax rate to 28% to pay for his $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan. Meanwhile, as the Republicans stall and string along the Democrats, Biden is keeping alive his alternative to go it alone via budget reconciliation, but that requires all 50 Democratic senators to be aboard. Then we'll assess today's appearance before the press of Ebrahim Raisi, the hanging judge and hardline cleric chosen by Iran's supreme leader, who was elected in the lowest turnout in the Islamic Republic's history. Abbas Milani, director of Iranian studies at Stanford University, who until 1986 taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, joins us to discuss the Orwellian nature of Raisi's claim to be a champion of human rights and how the clerical regime is living in its own world while average Iranians are suffering real-world deprivation, in part thanks to U.S. sanctions. Then finally, we'll go to Venezuela, which used to be one of the richest countries in South America, but is now becoming a failed state, with over 5.6 million of its 30 million citizens having fled the country since 2015. With a woefully incompetent regime holding onto power via a military corrupted by the drug trade that is now going to war inside its own country against gangs who control whole neighborhoods. We'll get an update from Phil Gunson, the Andes Project senior analyst with the International Crisis Group, who has spent over 40 years reporting on Latin America. And joining us now is Edward McCaffrey, who is the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward McCaffrey.
Always great to be here, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ed. And do you expect anything constructive or useful to come out of this so-called bipartisan group led by Senators Sinema and Rob Portman? They were supposed to issue their bipartisan infrastructure plan today. They're going to be meeting this evening, so we may get it tomorrow. But what we know about it so far is, one, the White House, the Biden administration said that they would not agree to a raise in the gas tax, the federal gas tax, to pay for infrastructure because that disproportionately affects working Americans. And there was also a suggestion that they might tax electric cars as a way to pay for infrastructure, which seems so counterintuitive. And that's infuriated the progressive Democrats who want an infrastructure bill that addresses climate change. So what do you expect will come out of this bipartisan group?
Okay, well, I think to give a short answer to your pretty long question there, I think that was all one sentence as I was listening. But you had early in there the phrase constructive and useful. Did I think anything constructive and useful would come out of what's going on now with Sinema? And so forth. And the answer to that is no. I think we're in an extended dance. I think it's just the same old story, right? So it goes back to these two things. It's politics and it's money, and it's money and it's politics, and these things are intertwined. I think Republicans are very happy. I think they took a gamble early that they would goad the Democrats into making spending proposals that would have to be paid for by tax increases. And there was a time when it looked like that might be the wrong bet. Now it's looking like the right bet. Nobody wants to be in favor of a salient tax increase. That's why the Democrats oppose breaking the filibuster rules. They want the filibuster rules. Nobody, Kamala Harris, doesn't want to be the deciding voter on a tax increase. So the Republicans have drawn a red line, no tax increases. That always means what it means for Republicans. No increases to the top rates under the income tax or the corporate tax. That's what cost George H.W. Bush. I know you're too young to remember those quivering lips, but George H.W. Bush has no new taxes. He goes along with an increase in the top marginal rate after Ronald Reagan, cowboy hero of tax-cutting fame, radically lowers taxes, and George H.W. Bush becomes a one-term president. I think Republicans with few issues that they think might actually be popular to run on, being a divisive party and a party of grievance, a party that's attacking voting rights and immigrants and on and on and on, I think if they get Democrats are going to raise your taxes, if that becomes an issue in the midterms, I think Republicans could well win. So, and whenever we draw that red line, no new taxes, no falling back on what Trump did in the tax cuts. No, first of all, Republicans can follow a red line such as that. It's very clear. And then second of all, the game becomes, what else can we do? Deficit spending, raise taxes that aren't salient, that don't count as taxes to Republicans, like gas taxes, like payroll taxes, like cigarette taxes, like cell phone taxes. Look for low salient taxes to get the masses to pay for whatever you want to do and draw the red line at not taxing the rich. And that looks like a political gamble that Democrats don't want to face right now. Democrats don't want to be on the line going into 2020. If you raise the corporate tax rate and there's a market crash, and there may be a market crash because there are market crashes from time to time, Democrats are in big trouble in 2022. So Democrats don't want to go into election as the party of tax increasers. Republicans are happy to throw that poisoned apple into the room. They're happy if the left wing, Sanders and AOC, sit out the whole thing because they can't, their fellow Democrats won't soak the rich. Republicans are just, that's a wet dream for Republicans.
So, Ed
that's
McCaffrey.
So I ended up with a long answer. Sorry.
Well, we know that the red line for the Republicans is no taxes on the rich. The Trump tax cuts for the super rich is sacrosanct. No raising the corporate tax. That's all pretty clear. So what about then, does that mean at the end of the day, Biden's only way, and he's keeping this option open while he talks to the Republicans or to Sinema and Portman and their group, which has now been joined by Senator Lindsey Graham on the idea of a bipartisan bill. Obviously, Biden himself has made it clear that he's partial to bipartisanship. But if it's as bad as you described it, which I agree with you, it's terrible. What about reconciliation, budget reconciliation? The problem with that is he could spend a lot more and get a lot more done and invest in the future, Biden could, but he'd need all 50 Democrats. So do you have to go through this process, have the Republicans blow it up, if that's possible, and then somehow Manchin and Sinema will decide to go along with all 48 of the other Democrats and go for reconciliation? Is that what it's going to require?
You know, another long and probably compound question there, Counselor, but a wonderful question. And I think to sort of break it down, I think partially what has to happen is Biden has to take a step back. I think there's that, go big or go home. There was that initial forward step, the momentum from the COVID relief bill, which is highly popular and relatively big. and then getting vaccines under control. But now the weather seems to have changed. Now we're in a more traditional trench warfare battle, and who's going to blink first and say yay to tax increases. So I think this is a moment to scale things down. You need to get something done on infrastructure. You need to keep your mandate up as a bipartisan president. You need bipartisan things to happen. So I think you take a skinny down, just like you were saying, Ian, I think you take a skinny down infrastructure that you get Republicans on board. You may not even get 10 on board for it, but you hope you, whatever you can get with 60, you get. Then you go to reconciliation. Also, as you said, Ian, when you go to reconciliation, it's not just that you only need 50 with Harris being the tie-breaking vote. And again, do you want that image? You know, the McCain thumbs down becomes the Harris thumbs up to legislation that's coded as a tax increase. But in reconciliation, you also don't have to pay for everything. You can just use the deficit. You can just add to the debt. And I think you'll see that move. I think another move you should see at some point is, and you're beginning to see it, is a wave at enforcement. The new voodoo economics. Republicans use supply side. We'll cut taxes, but somehow it'll make money. I think Democrats are going to use enforcement. We'll give the IRS more money and we'll miraculously generate all these funds, which we can use in the scoring process. And the fact that we won't actually collect them, you know, that'll be figured out later. So I think you'll see those things with some skinny down Democratic ambitions. And I don't really expect reconciliation. It's certainly not the time for a wealth tax. It's not the time for the Bernie Sanders, you know, just the 99% act. You know, I think Democrats have to be very cautious going into 2022 that they don't get stuck with a tax increaser label, however unfair that is. And then, you know, Biden has to, you know, the bipartisan centrist element of the Democratic Party has to get its act under control and figure out how to run this fragile coalition.
Well, none of this is encouraging, I'm afraid. It's obviously the Republicans' proposals are weighted towards physical infrastructure, roads, bridges, broadband, etc. The Democratic plans are weighted towards what they call human infrastructure. Parents can actually go to work and the kids get taken care of, and investing in clean energy that would power a much expanded electric grid that would take care of electric transportation. Incredibly ambitious, but also incredibly necessary. So are we simply watching here the worst of Washington sausage making for all of its sort of corrupt, you know, I mean, the idea that so many of these legislators, we've turned them into telemarketers. They spend their days dialing for dollars, and so many of them are in the thrall or in the pocket of wealthy plutocrats who don't want their taxes raised and who have made out like bandits. You don't think that there's anything out there in the zeitgeist that can affect this idea that at the end of the day, no new taxes is going to be the victor?
Well, I think the answer, that's another wonderful question. And I think the answer, as the answer to any good question like that would have to be, is yes, but it will take time. It's not going to happen in the short term. And I think if you look at American politics, really kind of going back to Reagan, I'm old enough to sort of base my you know, benchmark sort of in the Reagan, the transition to Reagan. And you see a Republican Party that's really, it's a coalition of two things. It is, you know, kind of lower income, the non-college educated cultural warrior, which has become the Trumpista, right? And then the money people. And if Republicans have, if taxes are too high, if there's a money issue, then the money people join with the cultural warriors. They fund the cultural warriors. They stoke the cultural warriors because they need to cobble together 50% or 47% with the right, with the right states to have power. And when you have that set up, you don't that median voter, the centrist voter that's going to tip, you know, a pretty bipolar electorate. They're too concerned about money, so Democrats have to get away from looking like they're tax increasers. And I think where you get hope is in the long term. If people can see that this more tepid, moderate, you know, Biden-style bipartisanism, however frustrating it is for people who want, you know, everything now, but it can slowly start getting things done while we get over Trump fever, while that piece of the electorate that seems to be blindly allied with a right-wing nationalist Trump-based agenda gets smaller and smaller. You know, when Trump becomes irrelevant and there are more reasonable people over there, then you'll see politics tilting left. But right now we have to wrench it from the jaws of a potential right-wing abyss. And to expect to move from that to some kind of left-wing progressive utopia, that's too quick, you know. So I think, you know, take the little victories in the center and make sure Biden gets reelected in 2024 as just a normal guy, and hope that you don't get thrown out of power in 2022, you know.
Bye.
That's where my hope is.
By what the Republicans are doing in their rigging the next vote, because they'd rather cheat than compete.
Yeah.
I mean, that is really, at the end of the day, another discussion.
But, you know, you kind of join all those discussions because you ask, well, why don't more Democrats come out in favor of breaking the filibuster so you can do obviously sensible things on voting rights and gun control and all these other issues where you could get to 50? I think the answer is they don't want to look like they have the power to raise taxes on the rich because they don't want to have that vote. So if you can do that, if you can get voting rights, why can't you get a wealth tax? And they don't even want to be talking about that. So in a way, the money issues keep you from becoming more progressive on the non-money issues. And the whole thing is, you know, we're all held hostage to the rich people. It's all, there's a George Carlin routine about how, you know, the rich corporations own us. We just work for them. And you know, on our darkest days, I think we can think that. So I'm still sticking with my prior answer and hope for a change in the zeitgeist. But, you know, we need to be patient and we need to be thoughtful about rushing into being characterized. You know, I've had a pretty long life observing politics, and when you can take a politician and make him Taxachusetts or, you know, tax and spend, or Bernie Sanders just looked like somebody who would spend a lot of your money as president, that is not, America is not a place that's going to elect anybody like that anytime too soon. So let's set that aside. Let's understand that well-meaning liberal politicians are going to be averse to supporting tax increases. And let's figure out what we can get done given that constraint, rather than trying to force them to appeal to a socialist wing that's going to doom them, you know?
Well, Ed McCaffrey, I thank you very much for joining us here. I appreciate it very much.
No, it's always my pleasure, Ian, and hopefully we'll get to chat again like this soon.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Edward McCaffrey, who is the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment of the appearance today before the press of Ebrahim Raisi, the hanging judge and hardline cleric chosen by Iran's supreme leader.
Outside the Paishan millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Abbas Milani, who's the Director of Iranian Studies and Professor at the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute at Stanford University. Until 1986, he taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center on International Relations. And his books include Lost Wisdom, Rethinking Modernity in Iran, The Persian Sphinx, and The Shah. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abbas Milani.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the new president of Iran, Ebrahim Raisi, held a press conference of sorts today. And he was pretty adamant, dismissive, actually, of even the possibility of meeting with Biden. But he did talk about wanting to proceed with the renewed talks to bring back the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal. So what do you make of the press conference and the attitude that was expressed by this new leader, largely referred to as a hardliner?
I thought it was an Orwellian event, some of his responses and some of the disconnect between what he said and the realities as we know them, whether it's the reality of them negotiating with the United States in Vienna or whether the election results in Iran, or whether it is his past record as the judge in a committee of death, or as the head of judiciary, on every one of these things, what he said and what at least I know of reality were very discordant.
So the fact that he was essentially chosen by the supreme leader as a protege, I guess, and other more reformist-minded candidates were purged and couldn't even get on the ballot. And then you mentioned at least 8,000 deaths that he may have presided over. I don't know whether he was one of a number of judges on a panel that decided to execute these 8,000 political prisoners at the end of the Iran-Iraq War. Is that fair?
Well, the figure I have heard is upward of 4,000, not 8,000. Mm-hmm. But he has also been responsible for many other executions of the opposition. He was in charge of that part of the judiciary that handled dissident groups, opposition groups. And there are many people who have written about their experience. So he has as bleak of a record as a judge and as a prosecutor. And then as a member of that group that is called the Committee of Death, you're absolutely right. It was a committee of four. One of them has traveled to Sweden, was arrested by the Swedish judiciary, and is on trial there for crimes against humanity. And I think Amnesty International just a couple of days ago issued a statement demanding that they put him on trial. So it is a very strange choice by Mr. Khamenei. I think the anemic election results, the lowest in the history of this republic, show the level of disgruntlement.
And the overall election results were 49% of the electorate voted, but the more alarming statistic was that only 34% voted in the Tehran district. So what would that indicate to you, Abbas? Does that mean the young and the women? I mean, they're pretty much disaffected in any case, aren't they?
I think they are. I think there is a widespread disgruntlement with the status quo and then also with Mr. Raisi as a person and with the process of eliminating anyone from within the regime. I'm not talking about the opposition, anyone from within the regime that could have potentially been a challenger to Raisi, including the head of the executive, the legislative branch, was one of the closest allies of Mr. Khamenei. They eliminated him as well because they thought he might be a challenger. So not only in Tehran, one out of four only voted in his favor, but there are serious allegations that they dumped in a large number of votes to add to his tally to make it a less embarrassing result. That stuff needs to be studied more. I think we will get more reliable information on how much votes they have added, actually, to bring this to this dismal number. I mean, the 48% that have voted is, I think, now increasingly the subject of doubt. And there are about 4 million people who, in obvious, concentrated, and orchestrated action, decided to submit blank ballots. Mr. Khamenei had clearly issued a religious fatwa saying that submitting a blank ballot is a sin, and at least 4 million people decided to commit a sin rather than vote for a sinner, I guess.
And again, I'm speaking with Abbas Milani, who's Director of Iranian Studies and a professor at the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute at Stanford University. Until 1986, he taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the Board of Directors of the University's Center on International Relations. And his books include Lost Wisdom, Rethinking Modernity in Iran, The Persian Sphinx, and The Shah. Well, it is obviously a rigged system from the outset. But do you think, when you talk about embarrassment, do you think that they're embarrassed? Do you think the Supreme Leader is capable of embarrassment, or this fellow, this hardliner, this hanging judge that they've just foisted on the Iranian people? Do you think he's capable of embarrassment? I mean, these people are real hardline theocrats, aren't they?
And they're not only incapable of embarrassment, they're even incapable of a modicum of decency. Today, a journalist from Al Jazeera asked him about his record on these murders. He could have shown a level of contrition. He could have said, I was just doing my job, unacceptable as that is, but it's the common answer given by people who have committed these kinds of crimes, who want to show some level of contrition. He, first of all, the translator, instead of translating the exact question, soft-pedaled the question. So that it wouldn't be insulting. Recognizing, I think, that thousands are going to be listening. Thousands are going to know that you're cheating on your simple job of translating. And then he said, in defiance, in truly Orwellian audacity, he said, I should be given an award for defending human rights. I didn't abuse human rights. I defended human rights when I killed those people, which is, the standard argument that the regime has given in the past for these executions. And so I don't think they're capable of contrition, and they seem to get more arrogant as the day goes by. And what they think in reality and how they portray themselves might not necessarily be the same. I'm not sure Mr. Khamenei is as off base from the realities of Iran as he seems to be. When he talks about the realities of Iran, to me, they're discordant from any reality that I know, any reality we know from the economy, from the disgruntlement of the people, from the number of people who flee Iran. From the number of people who, according to the regime's own statistics, are clinically depressed, the number of addicts, all of this is a society in crisis. And when you listen to him, or you listen to Raisi today in this Orwellian interview, they seem to be traveling in a different world.
Well, I mean, obviously the people are demoralized. It's a phony democracy. But to some extent, isn't there a symbiosis between the hardliners on the outside and the hardliners running Tehran? I mean, what Trump did, and it's obvious that the Supreme Leader wants the JCPOA to be revived and is backing these talks, and so is Raisi. But the fact that Trump pulled out the deal, didn't that play into the hardliners' hands? They said, see, you can't trust the Americans, so... What kind of symbiosis is there? Can you make the case that the hawks on our side simply feed the hawks on their side? And is there any way, if that's what you accept, is there any way to break that dynamic?
I think to some extent that's absolutely true. The narrative of the hawks sometimes in Washington and the hawks in Iran are very much the same. The hawks in Iran used to talk about the nuclear deal as the worst deal in history. In Iran, I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Donald Trump. Mr. Khamenei's allies were dismissing the nuclear deal as the worst deal in Iran's history. They said it's the most one-sided deal. And almost like verbatim, the same thing was being said in Washington. So there is that symbiosis. There is that feeding of each other's frenzy. But the sanctions clearly hurt the Iranian people most of all, but they also hurt the, this regime. The reason Raisi and Khamenei are now negotiating, I think, is because they really have no choice. The economy is on the verge of collapse. They need to negotiate. But they want to have the cake and eat it too. They want to negotiate. They want to try to end the sanctions. But they want to say that we're not negotiating with the United States because Mr. Khamenei has declared it unacceptable to negotiate directly with the United States. It's profoundly hypocritical. They're clearly negotiating with the United States. They clearly have in the past. But it's part of his revolutionary rhetoric that we don't negotiate with the United States. And the people who pay the price are the poor people of Iran and the workers of Iran who haven't been paid for months. And if they strike, they get mowed down in streets as they did 2 years ago.
So again, one wishes this agony to go away, and I wish there was a better way to put pressure on the outside to bring about the results instead of the sanctions essentially punishing the people and rewarding the regime to the extent to which the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and others are able to make a lot of money on the black market, etc. This happens all over. I mean, you know, you have failed states like Zimbabwe with the worst kind of government in the world, but they stay in power because the people just get exhausted through poverty and alienation. So is there any way to end this agony? I mean, we seem to be have a zombie-like policy towards Iran that hasn't yielded any fruitful results, and we demand that they stop producing missiles and supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. Of course, there's no way in the world that they won't do that. Is there a better strategy here that could be employed?
I think there is a better strategy, and the better strategy is if you put any pressure on the regime, make it the kind of pressure that is directly hurting the regime, is hurting the IRGC, not the Iranian people. There should have never been sanctions on medicine, for example. There should have never been sanctions on food. But the Iranian regime should also be told clearly, categorically, by the international community. I don't think China or Russia are going to join. But if Europe and the United States do say clearly, categorically, we're not going to negotiate with you if you take dual citizens hostage. We're not going to negotiate with you if you take citizens of England or France or Germany hostage to have your terrorists released. This is what they've done repeatedly. If they make it clear to them that the dark practices of the past are no longer going to hold, you can negotiate with this regime. Look, what Belarus did in bringing down a plane illegally and bringing a dissident, arresting them, and within 24 hours bringing them after torture, apparently, on television, having them repent and accept his so-called defeat. That's what the Iranian, and the world was in rightful anger about what Belarus did. But the Iranian regime does this regularly in the last 2 years. They have killed at least two journalists this way. Why isn't there the same kind of resistance, the same kind of condemnation? You can't bring down a plane and arrest people. You can't hijack journalists from Iraq or Turkey and bring them to Iran and execute them. This is what they have done, and they have virtually paid no price.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Abbas Milani, can Iran sort of survive with its increasingly close relationships with China? or are these sanctions and the isolation from Europe at the end of the day going to work? I mean, in other words, do the Ayatollahs have an alternative? Obviously, they want the sanctions lifted. But what's their long-term economic prognosis? Because
I think you put it exactly on the most important point. They think their saviors are China primarily and diplomatically Russia. They think they've virtually offered a very lucrative deal to China, a $450 billion 25-year deal. China hasn't signed on yet because China has more worries than just Iran. China is making lucrative deals with Saudi Arabia, with United Arab Emirates. China has extensive dealings with Israel, with Turkey. So China is not going to put all of its eggs in Iran's basket. For Iranian regime, that is clearly what they hope as a possible way out of the crisis they have created for the Iranian people and for themselves, because I think they are at a very dangerous moment for their own survival as well.
Well, but the last time when you had the Green Revolt, it was brutally put down. And you mentioned more recently when workers went on strike, they were brutally suppressed. So we can't expect anything like that, can we, from the people, from the young, etc. Even though they hate the regime, there's no chance of a popular uprising. I mean, these people are ruthless, the Pasdaran and the IGC. Remember, the reason that dreadful regime in Syria survived, the Assad family, this mafia family, when the people rose up against them, Bashar al-Assad ordered his army to shoot the people in the streets. And after a while, the soldiers couldn't do it. They couldn't fire on their own people. So who did they turn to? The IRGC. And they provided the snipers who shot people indiscriminately to the point where the people had to retreat. So that's what you're dealing with there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the Iranian regime is very much responsible for keeping the Assad regime in power at great expense to the Syrian people, to the Lebanese people, to Afghans who were sent there as proxies, who were paid by Iran to be sent there as proxies. Iran eventually sent even regular troops to fight on behalf of Assad and maintaining this regime in power. You're right. But, you know, I think you study history, and the thing that surprises you is that how despotism falls in spite of their sense of invincibility, because they think they have intelligence ministries, they have guards, they have red guards, blue shirts, that they can survive. But people's resilience and people's creativity and people's desire to fight oppression is always, always has been stronger than the selfishness of greedy authoritarian and almost always corrupt leaders.
Well, Abbas Manani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Abbas Manani, who's Director of Iranian Studies and a professor at the Center on Democracy, Development and the Rule of Law at the Freeman Spogli Institute at Stanford University. Until 1986, he taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science, where he was also a member of the board of directors of the university's Center on International Relations. And his books include Lost Wisdom, Rethinking Modernity in Iran, The Persian Sphinx, and The Shah. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to oil-rich Venezuela, now becoming a failed state, with over 5.6 million of its 30 million citizens having fled the country since 2015.
Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. la potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra. El pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Phil Gunson, the Andes Project Senior Analyst with the International Crisis Group, who conducts advocacy on political issues in the Andes region, focusing primarily on the Venezuelan political situation. He has spent over 40 years reporting on Latin America for the BBC World Service, The Guardian, Newsweek, The Miami Herald, and The Economist, and he's co-authored two books on the region, including a two-volume political dictionary of Latin America and the Caribbean. Welcome to Background Briefing, Phil Gunson.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's a very depressing article, Phil, in The Guardian, Latin America Will Never Be the Same, Venezuela Exodus Reaches Record Levels. And apparently more than 5.6 million Venezuelans have left the country since 2015. And at that time, the population of the country was 30 million people. So that's a pretty high percentage of the population. Do we have any figures on what the numbers are, what the percentage are of Venezuelans who've already left their country?
Yes, well, as you say, I mean, that is a huge number. In fact, it's, I believe, in just absolute terms, it's the second biggest refugee crisis in the world after Syria. Of course, most of the people from Venezuela, most Venezuelan refugees, migrants, have moved to countries where at least they speak the same language and the culture is fairly similar. So the assimilation is not quite so difficult as, say, with Syrians moving to Europe. But it is a massive part of the population. Perhaps a sixth or more of the population has left.
And there's also a difference in terms of the way the Europeans are spending quite a lot of money on refugee aid to Syria, I guess, in a way to prevent too many refugees landing in Europe itself. But no such generosity appears to be happening in the Northern Hemisphere, although the Canadians are leading an effort. And I guess most of the aid has to go to Colombia, right? Colombia is where most of the Venezuelan refugees end up.
Yes, some have got a small percentage have returned since the pandemic hit because, of course, the situation in Colombia is extremely bad as well, and many people simply couldn't survive there. But yes, the figures reached around 1.8 million Venezuelans at one point. I'm not sure exactly what it is now in Colombia, and similar situations prevail in a little bit further south in Peru, in Ecuador. And even as far south as Chile and Argentina, there are many, many Venezuelans. I mean, it's true that the generosity has not been so great by a long way with the Venezuelans as it has per capita in the Syrian case. But as you rightly point out, a large part of the reason for that, I think, is that Europe is, if you like, defending itself against a large wave of refugees. Whereas, of course, these Venezuelans are not in a position to arrive on the shores of Europe or even the United States in rubber boats or by walking. They're a lot further away. So the countries in the immediate vicinity, like Colombia, are the ones who are dealing with it and having to spend most of the money.
So you're there in Caracas, Phil. Is there any sense that the Maduro government has any idea of what a catastrophe they've been for the Venezuelan people? I mean, they send out their slogans and all the time, and it's all basically a sort of hollow cheer squad. They must have some support, but with the businesses collapsing, food distribution collapsing, the medical system totally collapsing, I mean, I guess they can blame it on the United States, but is there any sense that Maduro is in any way taking responsibility for the disaster he's wrought that country?
I think the short answer to that is no. I mean, as you say, they do blame U.S. sanctions, which Certainly haven't made things any better, and in some respects have made them considerably worse. But the basis of the problem is not the sanctions. The basis is extreme economic mismanagement, dismantling of institutions, corruption, an extremely incompetent, incapable management, in particular of the economy. No, the government seems to be, it's hard, of course, to know exactly what goes on in the minds of the people at the top of the government. But I think there it's pretty clear that their prime aim is to stay in power. And they have rigged the electoral system in such a way as to ensure that. But of course, fundamentally, their power depends on the fact that they control the armed forces. And when there have been mass demonstrations, and even some attempts to, rather feeble attempts to overthrow them, they've always been able to respond with force. And they, so far, they have managed to ratchet up the force whenever required in order to meet any particular threat. So, no, I think the basic answer to your question is no, there isn't a sign that the government is willing to take responsibility for the crisis.
So, given that the military backs Maduro, and apparently the Cuban intelligence people have heavily infiltrated the military to make sure that they're all on side, and there are no, you know, none of that sort of Latin American coup attempts going on. But at the same time, it seems to be the military has become a drug dealing operation. There have been clashes on the border between the Venezuelan military and the Colombian rebels. And it's not over territory, it's over their payoffs to the generals, right? For corridors of shipping cocaine out of Colombia through Venezuela. And we've just learned about the Venezuelan-Turkey connection through this character that's a mafia boss that's sending these videos from the Gulf into Turkey that have become the number one rated political show in Turkey, where he's explained how many of the top officials in Erdogan's government are in the drug trade, involved in transshipments of cocaine from Venezuela via Turkey into Europe and beyond. So how much has the Venezuelan military devolved, or how much has the Maduro government devolved into a kind of drug dealing operation?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because it's something that is frequently alleged, and I think we have to be a little bit careful. It's certainly true that a lot of drugs go through Venezuela, and it's really not surprising that that's the case. First of all, of course, you have the world's biggest cocaine producer, Colombia, sharing a, what is it, 2,200-kilometer border, roughly, with Venezuela. And Venezuela is a pretty lawless place where it's certainly possible for drug traffickers to pay off police, military, and anybody that might otherwise get in their way, using Venezuelan territory to transship drugs on their way either to Europe or to the United States primarily. But the reason why I say we have to be careful about it is that I think there's that some of the allegations that fly around are politically motivated. I mean, I think certainly in the case of the Turkish allegation that you mentioned, we really don't know yet whether that's true or not. These are allegations which, I mean, are plausible enough. There's no reason why these allegations from this Turkish mafia boss should be dismissed out of hand, but they haven't been proven. And we have to remember that for the Venezuelan opposition and those who support it outside, drugs is a very useful button to press, if you like, when you're trying to get action from the United States government in particular. Another important, useful button is the terrorism one, which is also used. None of that is to say that drugs, terrorism are not an issue or a fear in the case of Venezuela, simply that some of what is said has to be discounted. And I think, for example, the flow of drugs through Venezuela is perhaps not as much as it is along other routes out of Colombia, particularly the Pacific route and up through Central America to Mexico. In terms of what's happening on the border, which you also raised, that's another very complex issue. What we have in Venezuela is a government that has allowed different kinds of armed groups, some of them more political, some of them more criminal, most of them a mixture of the two, to take over and use various parts of the territory, rural and urban. And occasionally these groups don't play by the rules that the government has explicitly or implicitly laid down. What seems to be happening on the border is that this particular part of the border in the southwest of Venezuela, between Venezuela and Colombia, is a very important trafficking route, not just for drugs, but for all sorts of other things as well. And it seems as if, and again, we're not absolutely clear, the government and the armed forces found it necessary to crack down on this particular group, rather unsuccessfully, it has to be said. But I think the major lesson to be learned from these clashes, this unrest in this particular border area, is that the government is no longer capable really of reestablishing territorial control over particular parts of the country that have been ceded to these different groups. And that's a very dangerous position to be in. I think it bodes ill for the future of Venezuela when the government and the armed forces are not capable of exercising territorial control. I think there's likely to be a series possibly of operations, if you like, to test the ability of the armed forces, the security forces in general, to control territory. We're already seeing in the case of Caracas, the capital, criminal groups that have taken over significant parts of the fairly central parts of the city, managing to hold out against quite significant offensives by police and security forces against them. So there's a sense that the government is kind of losing its grip.
So you're describing something that's similar to the wars in the favelas in Brazil, are you not? Where criminals just take over big chunks of a city and they have a running sort of civil war with the law enforcement?
It's very much like a war. Yeah, I mean, the kind of weaponry that's being used, I mean, we're talking about automatic rifles, hand grenades and so on, armored vehicles. The other day, I'm trying to think, it was about a week ago, a little bit more than a week ago, 10 days ago, the government sent in reportedly around 1,000 members of the security forces into a particular barrio, not very far, really, from the presidential palace. And by the end of the day, we were seeing photographs of them taking over a network of trenches at the top of this barrio. This is a very hilly area. Trenches and command posts that looked as if they were set up in a war zone. By a few days later, these criminal groups had retaken the territory that the government had won back. And this seems to be the pattern. The government moves in, but as soon as the security forces are redeployed elsewhere, the criminals take over again. And of course, then you get reprisals against the civilian community who are already suffering greatly at the hands of the police, who shoot first and ask questions afterwards.
But to try and get a handle on it, we talked a little bit about the drug trade, and obviously there were early reporting on Maduro's own family, his wife's family in particular, were involved in the drug trade, and some of the, I think her nephews got busted importing cocaine into the United States. But so if there's criminality going on at the government level, at the same time the government is trying to secure its own territories and its own community within the city, within miles of the presidential palace, what are the criminals about then? What are they offering? What are they, I mean, not offering, that's not the right way to put it, because they're probably parasites, but what do? They take over and it's like they just run the area like the mafia would?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, sometimes you get situations in which the civilian inhabitants, who of course are the sandwich, the meat in this particular sandwich, the civilian inhabitants prefer particular gangs over other gangs or even over the security forces because they feel safer when things are solidly in the hands of one particular group. The problem, of course, is when the territory is disputed. It's not as if life is great when a particular criminal organization is running your barrio. But given the available alternatives, they prefer peace rather than war, as you might imagine. Certainly when the government is in control, or when the government is seeking to take control of a particular barrio, the only thing that the civilians can do is really keep their heads down. And we see a lot of cases, not only of civilians being caught in the crossfire, sometimes quite a long way from the actual scene of the battle, because, of course, a bullet from a high-powered rifle goes a long way. But also police, what are effectively police death squads, moving in, pulling young men from their homes, shooting them execution style and leaving the bodies on the street. This is something that the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and other human rights organizations have been reporting in detail in recent years. And it's a very, very worrying development, not because extrajudicial executions are new in Venezuela, they certainly aren't, but the scale of this is extraordinary. The latest figure I recall seeing in the last few days was around 500 extrajudicial executions reported just in the year so far. So, you know, we're about halfway through 2021. That's how many we've reported. And there are probably many more that don't actually get reported.
Well, Phil Gunson, I thank you very much for joining us and giving us a picture on this dystopian situation in this once incredibly prosperous South American country now that has been absolutely brought to its knees by, as you mentioned earlier, largely through incompetence and mismanagement. I thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much indeed.
And again, I've been speaking with Phil Gunson, who is in Caracas, Venezuela. He's the Andes Project Senior Analyst with the International Crisis Group, and he has spent over 40 years reporting on Latin America for the BBC World Service, The Guardian, Newsweek, The Miami Herald, and The Economist, and he's co-authored two books on the region, including a two-volume political dictionary of Latin America and the Caribbean. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written